Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue, and joining us is a guy who's no stranger to All Marine Radio, Mark Cancian. Mark, first of all, thanks for joining us. How's the homeschooling going?
There's a reason that I pay the school system to educate my children. It's because I don't want to homeschool. So we're doing okay.
Okay. What's the greatest challenge of homeschooling?
We seem to have a disagreement about whether summer vacation has started early or whether school is continuing in a different manner.
So just a general discipline problem, it sounds like to me.
It's a focus problem. we're making a little progress, but I think I, like a lot of parents, will be happy when the schools reopen. Unfortunately, here in Virginia, they don't reopen until maybe the fall.
Yeah, so good luck with that. How were you?
Thanks.
I have a daughter who's a junior in high school, and they're doing distance learning. So we're not homeschooling, thankfully. And so I just threatened her. I said, if you screw this up and your grades suck, okay, you're going to pay, just so you know. So that's the extent of my involvement in her education. I'm not nearly as hands-on, you know, but I do love her. I profess that I love her, but I've not gone to being involved in her homeschooling, which is probably a good thing.
I can say, yes, it is a good thing.
All right. For those of you who don't know, Mark, if you go in and take a look at his bio, he's a big time thinking guy and works at CSIS and been on the program before. So, Mark, you know, we've heard General Berger's discussion and his announcement last year that Marine Corps 2025 would no longer be. Was suspended. It was not. It would not be implemented. You know, all those documents were taken down and scrubbed from Marine Corps websites. The campaign plan, I believe, started under General Conway. General Amos continued it. General Neller, continued that. And you could see, iterations of that if you just go online and take a look at it. That the Marine Corps would be getting new planning from the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And he teased much of it. And then this past week, Michael Gordon, formerly of the New York Times, and a very well-respected writer on defense issues, wrote an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. And then Marine Corps Combat Development Command came out with a statement relative to the future of the Marine Corps, units that would be going away, strengths that would be going away. So I wanted to have you on and talk about that. First of all, give me your general reaction to all of that in light of your previous Don't Go Crazy Marine Corps article.
Sure. And I would say up front that CSIS just posted within the last 5 minutes my analysis of the Marine Corps restructuring plan.
Well, tell him I'm not happy about that, because I looked for it this morning and I thought I need to read that before he comes on. And I'm looking, I'm like, where the hell is it? He told me it would go up Wednesday. So tell them one person is not real happy with him.
Okay. I have to say that I got a couple of last minute comments and wanted to, from the Marine Corps and wanted to be fair to them. But it's up and it's about 3,000 words and looks at the restructuring plan in a lot of detail. And I've been able to get more detail than has come out publicly because of some private discussions. And Michael Gordon and I have been talking over the last week or two. He was gracious to provide a little more detail. So what you'll see there is probably the most detail you'll see in public. Plus, okay, so, there's a lot of my speculation.
Well, and that's what we really want. We want your speculation. We don't just want the so where do I find it? I'm looking at your page, and I don't see it up there. I see The Art of Surprise, Coping With. And then more recent from Mark Cancian is COVID-19 Response, Pentagon. So where would I find this thing that was just posted?
Give it a minute. The webmaster just said he was putting it up. So,
okay. All right. Go ahead.
But let me talk to it, and then maybe by the end of our conversation, it'll be up.
Okay, let me just frame some previous discussions that we've had here. The Marine Corps' utility to the nation historically has been as the great Swiss Army knife. That
yes.
We can become heavy when we need to. We have that in our inventory. We can become lighter when we need to participate as the nation's 911 force in readiness and get there, to fight tonight in any climb and place and acquit ourselves well. Now, we have been most often used in that capacity. And the last time that, we prosecuted anything that would come close to what we would call a naval campaign, which would be a poor substitute for it, but it would be, an orphan, stepbrother would be, Korea. And so when we look at this construct, the Marine Corps is going to go seemingly all in on the confrontation with China in the South China Sea. Even in 3MEF, when you go up to the Korean Peninsula, that fight is vastly different. It would be vastly different in Iran. It would be vastly different in Europe and Norway. And then there's the whole question of, and I believe you're the one that sensitized me to this, and that was the way we use our reserve. So in trying to make sense of this, right, of how this fits into the national defense strategy, right, that's the box that this discussion kind of sort of takes place in. Yes,
exactly.
Okay.
Let me lay out the Marine Corps' arguments for the restructuring, and then we can talk about the reservations that I have and that you expressed. The Marine Corps makes several arguments. The first one is that China is the great threat. That threat is identified in the National Defense Strategy, which calls for reorienting all the armed forces on great power conflict, giving them primacy, and that this strategy does that by reshaping the Marine Corps to conduct a maritime campaign or to participate in a maritime campaign in the Western Pacific. So it gets rid of capabilities that would be needed for sustained ground combat. So tanks are gone. Bridging equipment is gone. I think some of the trucks will also be gone, although the Marine Corps did not talk about that. The Marine Corps also argues that the Army is responsible for sustained ground combat, and therefore those conflicts that require that, Korea, Iran, would be Army responsibilities. The Marine Corps would participate in littoral aspects, but would not be part of the sustained ground combat.
We don't do windows.
Well, yes. Now they. Well,
right.
Yes. The Marine Corps also argues that they are implementing a new warfighting concept. This is distributed operations, whereby small groups of Marines would be placed on islands to create air and naval bubbles using missiles to attack ships and missiles to attack aircraft, and therefore would hem in the Chinese, and as part of a joint campaign, this hemming in then would push them back to the mainland. And finally, Berger says that the defense budget is probably going to be flat, and a lot of people agree with him on that, so that he had to make some trade-offs. Over the last 5 years, all the services have had the good position, the benefit of having a rising budget so that they could invest in new technologies and still keep the forces the same or grow them a little. With a flat budget, they're not able to do that. So that's why he cuts personnel going from about 185 down to 170 for the active force. That would take the Marine Corps down about a little below where it was in 2000 when the wars began. Right now, the Marine Corps is, 185 active. And of all the services, it's the only one that's coming out of the wars larger than it went in. So this would take the Marine Corps back. Now, what are the risks? And I think you put your finger on the risks. So the first one is that the next war may not be in the Western Pacific. In fact, if you look at the history of the last 70 years, although the United States is prepared for great power conflict during the Cold War, of course, it was against the Soviet Union,
right.
We were able to deter that conflict and ended up fighting a whole bunch of other conflicts, regional conflicts. And that may be the case in the future. The second risk is that the Marine Corps day-to-day is going to be smaller and not as well structured to participate in the kind of forward deployments that is traditionally done. The Marine Corps argues, looking at the big conflict, that first, if it needs capabilities, it would be able to get them from the Army. For example, if it needs tanks as part of the joint force, it could get those from the Army. My reservation about that is that the Army is awfully much, also much smaller,
right.
And
right.
May not be able to give the Marine Corps the kind of support for tanks and sustained ground combat that the Marine Corps needs, that the Army will need all of that for its own support, it being much smaller now than it was in the past. Marines may remember that in Desert Storm, the Army sent a brigade, the Tiger Brigade, to operate with the Marines. I think it was with 2nd Division, but I could be wrong. And that was true, but as soon as the Tiger Brigade got back to the United States, it was disbanded. And the only reason that it was available was that its division had been disbanded, and it was an orphan for about a year. The Marine Corps could use it. That's no longer the case. If the Marine Corps were going to get those capabilities, they would come out of the Army Reserve components. So a tank brigade supporting the Marine Corps would likely be a National Guard tank brigade, and that would take at least 90 days and probably more to get into theater, you know, probably closer to 120, 180 days to get into theater. And you know, that's not the rapid response I think that the Marine Corps has exemplified in the past. The other
– Hey, Mark, yeah, just a footnote to that. Has the Army commented at all on that part of the Marine Corps? Have they said, that's not a problem?
No, they have not. And in fact, they have said – in the past, when these kinds of issues have arisen, the Army has said, we are not programming any forces to support the Marine Corps. Now, that doesn't mean that a joint force commander couldn't take forces from the Army and give them to the Marine Corps. I mean, that's, you know, joint force commanders have that prerogative, but the Army is not building any forces to do that. Any combat forces. Now, the Army does build some logistics forces to support the entire theater. So, for example, the Army does have port units that will support everybody, you know, who's getting logistics through the port. But it's not building tank units. It's not building engineering units. It's not building, you know, long-distance trucking units to support the Marine Corps. And one final note, you know, looking back on the last 70 years, when you think about where the Marine Corps has fought, Korea, Vietnam, and twice in Iraq, the new Marine Corps would not be able to conduct those operations. I mean, it would not have the spectrum of capabilities that it would need. Now, it could retool itself to build those capabilities, but doing that during wartime is a very risky operation. You know, there's a delay and there's a price to be paid in blood and treasure as militaries try to build these capabilities that it had not prepared for. And in fact, if you look back in the history of warfare, you see lots of examples of militaries that structured themselves for one kind of operation, but then had to fight a very different operation. Anyway, having said all that, and all of those risks, which I think are very real, and the Marine Corps, I think, has taken them too lightly, I would not propose that the Marine Corps make no changes. Many of the changes, I think, should have been made years ago. I'll come back to that in a second. The word that I would leave with everybody And this is the foot stomp. You know how they used to, in military classes, you know, they just stomp their foot for things right. that's going to be on the exam. The foot stomp is hedge. I think the Marine Corps should hedge against other kinds of conflict, even as it prepares for an island campaign in the Western Pacific. One way you can do that is through the reserves. The other services, particularly the Army and the Navy, keep certain capabilities in the reserves just in case they need them, so that their reserve components do not mirror the active component. They are complements. It appears that the Marine Corps is not doing that, not using the reserves as a hedge. And my recommendation would be to do that. For example, keep some tanks in the reserves. You know, maybe one company on active duty and say three or four in the reserves. And, you know, just in case you need it. You don't use a lot of active duty personnel, but you still have that capability, I say, that you can draw from. One of the places where I think the Marine Corps did get it absolutely right, I'll give you two places where it got absolutely right for changes that are long overdue. One is the use of UAVs, right. armed UAVs. The Marine Corps has a few ISR UAVs, but it is far behind the other services in fielding armed UAVs, the Predators and the Reapers. If you compare the Marine Corps and the Air Force, the Air Force has 284 armed UAVs. The Marine Corps has three.
Not three squadrons.
Right. Three aircraft.
We have been clown-like in that part, Mark. And for those of us that you know saw the development from 2004 in Iraq when I first got there to last time I was forward deployed was 2010, 2011. In those 7 years, the advances were absolutely unbelievable. The Marine Corps not embracing them caused us to burn up our fixed-wing assets doing jobs that drones could have done.
I mean, absolutely.
We still have been resistant because now we need to develop, right, this high-end, right, amphibious platform that's got to do everything that the Reaper does, you know, but off an amphibious platform. Really?
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense.
That is still the plan, and I think that is – I think Berger's allowing too much delay. I think – frankly, marine aviation would be comfortable sticking with manned aircraft. They've, you know, put their chips down on the F-35 and have been quite unenthusiastic about unmanned. And that MUX that you referred to, I think 2024 maybe. You know, whereas if they decided to buy Reapers, they could buy some tomorrow.
I read an article that one of the lieutenant colonels that was part of a group that worked on it, you know, said, hey, look, you can lease them today.
You can
lease them today. And so I very frustrating for a lot of guys in that community. And let me tell you, I think that, and I read this quote from Elon Musk, the day of the fighter pilot is done. You know,
marine aviation does not accept.
Oh shit! Most of them get livid about it, and to me, what you're going to see is a migration where you were going to have one manned system and a half a dozen unmanned systems that are data linked to that guy and are controlled by that guy. That's the evolution, and those drones are going to be way cheaper. You know, just like submarine drones. They're going to be out there looking for everybody, and they can ping the shit out of everything, and who cares if that drone gets blown up? Nobody.
Right.
And so that's the future, whether they like it or not. And so I would absolutely 1,000% agree with you. Marine Corps is much too slow on the uptake of that, and that is the future.
The other place where the plan invests heavily, and I think is long overdue, is on anti-ship missiles and the capability of exercising sea control from the land. And this harkens back to an old Marine Corps capability, the defense battalions of World War II.
I don't know if I need to teach you a history lesson. That didn't work out very good.
the concept was that, you know, Marine Corps would have units that would defend four naval bases.
Right.
And they built a lot of them and used them extensively in World War II. Now, the one on Wake Island, you know, held out for some time. It was finally overrun. But the idea was that it would defend the naval base against both sea-borne threats. So it had, you know, anti-ship guns and air anti-aircraft. Over the course of the war, they became mostly anti-aircraft because the seaborne threat declined. So the Marine Corps is rebuilding that capability, and that is a that would be something that if the Marine Corps, you know, you put those on an island and around the South China Sea, it could serve to hem in the Chinese and would give, I think, the Marine Corps a real leading role in that kind of conflict. So I think that that is a very sensible capability to add to the Marine Corps.
Just explain this. So it is the Marine Corps missile battery, whatever, the anti-ship missile battery, right?
Yes.
Guarded and moved by a Marine Corps organization that may not be akin to an infantry company, but it's some kind of company that moves and secures this thing throughout a littoral area.
That's right.
Is that controlled by the Naval Force Commander through some kind of, you know, Harry Potter shit?
Interesting question. The actual unit, I think, is going to be cast as an artillery unit. I think it's going to be part of the artillery. And the Marine Corps has a system. They're putting what are called tactical tomahawks onto a truck. And they've tested that.
Got it.
I mean, you're asking some questions about sensors, and I have to say I'm not sure about the sensors. But this would be, you know, because it's part of a naval campaign, of course, you know, it would come under a joint force commander, and I'm not sure what the command relationship with the Navy would be, but clearly it would have to be pretty close so that when we fire off one of these missiles, it's aimed at a Chinese ship and not a U.S. Navy ship.
But it would be a theater-wide, you know, event, yes? I mean, we're going to plug this architecture. It's not going to be a local, right? The strategic corporal is not going to decide to shoot that tomahawk.
One would presume, yes.
Okay.
But I'm not going to speak for the Marine Corps on that. And to be fair, they're still working out the details on, you know, distributed operations and how this kind of unit would operate. But I think it's a very useful capability in the Western Pacific when you're facing a naval threat. So I think those are two things in the plan that make a lot of sense. I understand the need to get a little smaller. There are some, you know, I'd say the hedging makes me the lack of hedging makes me a little nervous. You know, the infantry battalions are going to get smaller. They're going to go down to about 720 or so, and probably give up most of their heavy weapons in order to be more commando-like. And, you know, that fits a concept of light units, you know, in the Pacific on islands. But again, you know, when you think about all of the other places that Marine infantry has been used, you know, those heavy weapons have been very valuable.
All right. What else do you want to tell me about what you've written before I start asking you questions?
There are a lot of aviation changes.
Right.
And you know, one of them is to reduce the number of F-35s, and the Commandant clearly signaled that in his earlier guidance last summer when he talked about moving away from exquisite, expensive platforms and towards unmanned. And the guidance does that, fewer F-35s, more UAVs. Does cut the number of attack helicopters by, I think, two squadrons, arguing that, you know, they don't bring a lot to a maritime fight because they don't have, you know, standoff munitions. At least this is my inference, that although the helicopters have pretty good range, you know, their weapons, Hellfires, are pretty short ranged. So you have to get very close to the Chinese and be very vulnerable. So they don't see as a bigger role. Their big cuts in the heavy lift, cutting by about a third the heavy lift helicopters, which will affect the new helicopter. This is the CH-53K buy. So that'll be cut by about a third. And that's just beginning procurement. Not much detail. Two things that are sort of gaps are, first, the reserves. There's clearly no desire to use the reserves as a hedge. There's no discussion about that. The reserves will lose its tanks and bridging companies. Looks like the reserves will also lose two infantry battalions, but not clear what else will happen to the reserves. So that's likely a work in progress, whether they'll get smaller, whether they'll have different kinds of capabilities. The other gap is logistics.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, it makes me uneasy that we're making these kind of cuts and we don't really have the plan for the reserves sketched out yet. I mean, isn't that fundamental to the plan? I'm thinking, so what is the plan for the reserves? And so if you don't have that fleshed out in your mind, why are you doing these other things already? And so I guess that's perplexing to me.
Well, I'll defer the Marine Corps on that, except that they're not planning to use the reserves as a hedge. And,
so how are they planning? So what's their planned use of the reserve then? You're going to leave that to the Marine Corps.
Yeah. I really don't know.
I can't believe I'm giving you this kind of intellectual latitude to just sidestep that. All right. I won't make you General Berger then.
In the guidance, the Commandant had talked about being overinvested in surge, what he called surge layer capacity in the reserve component, which implied that the reserves were going to get smaller, but I say that's not hasn't been laid out yet. Also talked about changing some command relationships, which, is one of those things I think that briefs well but doesn't work very well in the real world.
In the reserves, the one thing we don't use is their headquarters elements, right? I mean, we use the we use the battalions, we use the companies, right. we take them, we activate them, we attach them to somebody, but the command elements we don't. So
no, that's right.
Right, the infrastructure that it has been the 4th Marine Division that came out of World War II and has survived all these years. To me, okay, all right.
Yep. No. And I think that's absolutely true. That the division wing structure and even the regiments, they've been occasionally used, but mostly it's at the battalion level. Yes, I mean, there's no question you could radically restructure those or even do away with them and turn them into some sort of, individual augmentation units, like what are called IMA units, which are pools right. of senior officers who you can then use to augment right. Staffs. And, all of our conflicts have needed large numbers of, augmentees. The language that the Commandant used was about formalizing command relationships between active and reserve component units.
Right.
Didn't talk about the headquarters. And I think the idea is to take some reserve units and align them with like 2nd Division or 1st Division or something like that.
Which is, I think, is smart, right? And so you get mobilized, you get activated in the summer, you go attached to 1st Marine Division, you have a habitual relationship with 7th Marines, you head out to the desert, there's already all the command infrastructure in place, there's a building, you come out, you train, then you go home. And if in case we need you, we can mobilize those guys in a hurry. So to me, that's good. I like that. I like that habitual thing.
Well, let me give you my pushback, because, what you say is absolutely true.
Okay.
The problem is, because they tried this in the 80s, and the problem was twofold. First, you ended up with two chains of command, so that, if a reserve unit were aligned with an active duty unit, but still had this relationship with a reserve regiment and reserve headquarters, it was now getting orders from two chains of command, and that got to be difficult on the battalion and company commanders. Now, if you eliminated the second chain of command, you know, then that problem would go away.
Right.
But the other problem was, we found in Desert Storm is when they called units up, they didn't call the aligned units up. So, for example, in Desert Storm, when they called up active duty units, they didn't look and see who had been aligned with those units. They went out to the reserves and said, who is the most ready reserve battalion? And they took that battalion and threw all of the alignments out the window. And when you think about it, you know, that's sensible. You know, that is, at Desert Storm, I say they asked, you know, who's the most ready reserve battalion? And the answer was, it's the two battalions that just went through CACs. Right, 29 Palms.
Right.
You know, these two battalions went through 29 Palms last summer. You know, they are ready. And, you know, off they went. And then they also went to the division commander, 4th Division Commander, and said, okay, we need one more. You know, who's the next best battalion? And he said, all right. And it turned out to be actually 125, which was my old battalion. You know, they're
Hua.
And off they went.
Right.
And, you know, when you think about it, that's a very sensible thing to do.
Right.
But it means that this alignment notion doesn't work very well. Now, maybe they would come up with something different, but that, you know, that's the problem you bump into.
Got it. Well, it would seem to be if you're aligned with me and I'm invested in your training, and then it would seem to me that, you know, I have part of my ops section making sure that, you know, assigning you tasks for your weekend training. And then I'm really interested in not only, you know, your first week is, you know, you're coming, you're going to do individual training. Then your second week, you know, that you're mobilized in the summer, you're going to be doing collective training with the regiment and whoever, you know, and as an integrated battalion in everything we do. So I think that if they were charged with that responsibility, then I think maybe that goes away. I like that idea.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and that's it. There are issues on which reasonable people could disagree.
Right.
But let me talk about one more thing that gets high visibility, and that's the naval side. Because there are three things that the commandant has talked about. The first one is small amphibs. And I would say this is also something that I think is a good idea, irrespective of the strategy. All of our amphibs now are extremely capable ships, but they're very large, very expensive, and very few. I think we have 32. And, you know, that, you know, LHDs, LHAs, you know, they cost $5 billion a piece. And sometimes, you know, you just don't need that much capability, particularly in wartime or in peacetime. And one of the problems they have is when they send a MEU out or an ARG, you know, first they find that they're almost always doing split operations. So the three ships rarely get together because, you know, there's this, that, and the other commitment that they need to meet. And if they had more ships, then they could meet more of those commitments. The other thing is that in wartime, you know, particularly under this concept the Marine Corps is discussing, you know, you don't want to send, you know, a huge ship with lots of Marines in a situation where it might get hit. Much better to send a couple of smaller ships that distributes your vulnerability.
Got it. And that's the whole getting to the fight problem, right?
Right. They're getting to the fight problem. That's right. And I think that's very sensible. Yeah, I think it's useful in peacetime. I think it's useful in wartime. It would also have a sort of a tertiary value in that it would make it easier in peacetime to get Marines onto amphibious ships. I remember back in the dark ages of the Marine Corps, in the 1970s, when I was in the basic school, and we had the BAS collects, you know, which is the basic school amphibious exercise.
Barflex, as the lieutenants used to call it.
What's that?
Barflex.
Barflex, that's right. But the great thing about the Barflex was that you actually got aboard ship.
Right.
What back in those days, they still had the LSTs, the county class LSTs. So they bussed us down to Norfolk. We got on the LST. The LST sailed down to North Carolina, and we did an actual amphibious landing. You know, Amtrak's, you know, paddled out from Camp Lejeune, second tracks. We got in them and, you know, we landed and, you know, did the amphibious thing. But they could do that because they had, in those days, I know, 50 odd amphibious ships because they had all these small LSTs. My two sons served in the Marine Corps. Neither of them ever went to sea. They never actually even got on an amphibious ship in their 4 years in the Marine Corps. Now, both of them, you know, deployed to Afghanistan, so the Marine Corps' focus was elsewhere. But the fact that they never, ever in their training got on an amphibious ship, you know, it was a real weakness, driven by the fact that there just aren't that many amphibs. And nowadays, you know, you just can't pull one of these very capable, expensive, rare, scarce resources and, you know, put a basic school company on it or put anyone else on it if they don't have a real reason for, you know, getting ready for a deployment. So the small amphibs, I think, make a lot of sense. And the commandant has called for that. He's also raised questions about the amphibious goal. You know, it used to be two MEBs. Right. And 38 ships. He said that they were not going to use that anymore, but he has not replaced that with a new target, so it's not clear. In part, that arises because of problems on the Navy side, which are unrelated to the Marine Corps. The Navy has been unable to produce its force structure assessment, which lays out what the fleet will look like in the future. There are a bunch of reasons for that. We can talk about that. Because of the Navy's inability to lay out what the future fleet looks like, we haven't had a chance to see what the future amphib fleet would look like if it moves away from this 38 large ships. The other thing, I'm laughing because the commandant and his guidance had a comment. I will read what he had in his guidance, and maybe you just have to be a Washington bureaucrat to really find it amusing. But let me read it. We must engage in a more robust discussion regarding naval expeditionary forces and capabilities not currently resident within the Marine Corps, such as coastal riverine forces, naval construction forces, and mine countermeasure forces. We must ask ourselves whether it is prudent to absorb some of those functions, forces, and capabilities to create a single naval expeditionary force. Now, what the commandant is really saying is, Navy, you have not given enough priority to these capabilities, and if you don't give them the priority they deserve, I'm going to build my own force. So far, the Navy has not responded, and we don't know where this is going to go, but this is sort of a shot across the Navy's bow to tell them to focus on these capabilities that the Marine Corps believes are important and are important, but which have always been lower priority for the Navy. So with that, let me let you ask a couple of questions here since I've been doing most of the talking.
Okay. So I'm perplexed that we're already announcing steps and we don't have a concept for the reserves. And we don't have assurances, it doesn't look like, from what you just articulated. We don't have assurances from the Navy of what they believe the future Navy looks like. So what guarantee? So we've come off the 38 or 36 amphib number and says we're going to find a different way to skin that animal, whether it's a cat, a dog, or a squirrel. We're going to find a different way to skin that. So the Marine Corps doesn't have a commitment for anything in the future. So why is the Marine Corps already, it seems like this is being, we're all in on the South China Sea fight to the expense yes. of every other fight and every other war plan that heretofore we've been a part of as America's 9/11 force and the great Swiss Army knife of the Department of Defense. Go anywhere and do things. Marines will go there. They'll get there quick. They'll acquit themselves well in every climbing place. We're now going to shit can all others, right, because we're going to be a littoral force. And yep. yet we have no assurance from the Army that they'll give us tanks, the Navy that the ships will be there. It just seems – and no concept of the reserve. I'm asking you to defend. I'm asking you to defend
yes,
that.
Yes, those are the risks I see. Now, I think the Marine Corps would say, would make a couple of responses. I mean, the first they would say that, you know, these sustained operations ashore are not our, that's not our job. That's the Army's job, and we are just going back to our traditional route, maritime routes.
Okay, and to which I would say, don't tell me about what your job is. Tell me about what you've historically done for the nation. So I love it that we have this, you know, advanced seizure of naval bases and your role as primarily as a naval service. But in the history of our nation, where the rubber has met the road, not where the Harry Potter crew lives, but where the rubber has actually, you know, met the road, this is what you provide for us. And what you're now doing is you are taking away this Swiss Army knife that I can apply throughout the range of Romo, right? And I can and where do I get these other forces? Does the Army have to expand? It would seem to be by necessity. I'm taking, you know, 100,000 fighters that have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm taking those off the table. And I'm telling you, we don't do windows. We're a littoral force committed to the South China Sea. And good luck with all those other war plans.
That's where I am. Yes. now, I say, to be fair, the Marine Corps, you know, they would say that, you know, that's the Army's job. I think they would also make the argument that, you know, in extremis, they could
vacate,
develop those. They could develop those capabilities. Now, my pushback on that is to point to the Army in Vietnam. You know, the Army had designed a force to fight on the central front in Europe, you know, tank-centric heavy combat. They then took that army and sent it to the jungles of South Vietnam, and the result was not a happy one. You know, that army was not very successful. It took a long time to adapt, and you know, some people argue that it never really adapted. You know, I think that sort of adaptation is much more difficult than the Marine planners are sort of acknowledging. But that is their argument.
Okay, let me ask you another question. Has warfare been transformed with artificial intelligence, hypersonic missiles, drones, yada yada, GPS, blah 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 blah? Has warfare been transformed and General Berger is a visionary, a la, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Ellis? Or are we constructing by virtue of data and tests the Maginot Line that was also supposed to be a transformation of war? And really what happened was it was simply an evolution of the existing principles of war. Where are we?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And that's why I keep coming back to the foot stomp phrase, hedge, because we really don't know. It might be if the next war were in the Western Pacific, and if the Marine Corps' concept for distributed operations and these forward deployed bubbles works, it will have been brilliant. And, you know, we would be likely successful in our endeavor. The problem is, if that's not the next war, or if this concept doesn't pan out, then the Marine Corps and the nation are in real trouble. That's why I keep coming back to hedge, in case you're wrong, because we really don't know. You know, people speculate that, you know, AI will transform warfare. Certainly drones, UAVs and unmanned vehicles have had an important effect. I don't know that I would argue that it has transformed warfare, but there's no question it has made things very difficult. But one of the big uncertainties out there is what a future great power conflict would look like. Because we've seen a lot of regional conflicts, and we have a pretty good handle on what a regional conflict looks like, you know, what a conflict within Iraq looks like, what a conflict with Afghanistan looks like. we don't know what a conflict with a great power would look like that can field the full spectrum of capabilities, at least close to its homeland, that the United States has. You know, we know that the sea will not be a sanctuary. We know that air will not be a sanctuary. But, you know, just how vulnerable it is, we really don't know. Richard Danzig, who was a former Secretary of the Navy, had a great article. It's short. It's about 10 pages, called Driving in the Dark. And he argued that DOD is driven to make predictions about future warfare, almost all of which are wrong, just because it's so hard to see that far in the future. And that's his analogy, you're driving in the dark. And therefore, he argues, hedging you have to hedge. And I'll give an example about how you can get it wrong. I'll give you two examples from history. The first one is before the Second World War. In 1937, Civil War breaks out in Spain as the right and the nationalists revolt against the left and the Republicans. And it turns into a three-year slog. I think it was 1936, but three-year slog. Both sides get outside support. The nationalists get support from the Italians and the Germans. The Republicans get it from the Soviet Union. Millions of soldiers involved, you know, dozens of divisions on each side, aircraft, tanks, you name it, that the patrons were supplying to their clients. The problem is, if you came out, if you were an observer, and there were many, who then wrote about this as a template for future warfare, you would come out and say, the next war is going to look a lot like World War I. It's primarily going to be an infantry struggle. Tanks will be helpful, but not decisive. Aircraft will be helpful, but not decisive. It's going to come down to the conflict ends in, I think, March 1939. In September, whatever, 6 months later, you know, the Germans unleashed the Blitzkrieg, an entirely different campaign than what the world had seen for the previous 3 years. And the point there is it's very hard to extrapolate from a regional conflict to what a great power conflict would look like. You can make a similar argument about World War I. And this is one of my hot button issues. In fact, I wrote a piece in War on the Rocks about this several years ago, that when people look back on World War I, they say, well, of course, Army should have anticipated that the machine gun would dominate the battlefield and that artillery would be very important and that there would be a stalemate in the trenches. Because when you look back at history, you could see at Petersburg, for example, in the American Civil War, how trench lines had arisen. And therefore, military should have recognized where warfare was going. The problem is that if you had looked at the wars just before World War I, and there were two Balkan wars, the specifics of which I'm a little vague on about who was ganging up on who. I think everyone was ganging up on the Ottomans, and then I think the Serbs turned on their allies, something like that, but it doesn't matter. But if you looked at how those wars played out, again, you had primarily infantry combat punctuated by sieges and sieges of towns, you know, just as you had been doing since, you know, the time of Rome. You know, in the time of Rome, armies would roam around the countryside and then lay siege to cities. And you saw the same thing in whatever it is, 1911 to 1913 in the Balkans. So you would look at that and you'd say, oh, you know, warfare hasn't changed. And then in 1914, of course, you now that you have great powers involved, you have a very different dynamic. So again, you know, seeing the future of warfare is really hard. And that's why I come back to, you know, the importance of hedging.
The congressional buy-in. When you start monkeying, I mean, Congress already did not agree to the navies. We're not going to buy this sub. We're not going to buy this ship. They said, yeah, that's DOA. Don't even bring that shit up here, because what you're doing is you're messing with, you know, jobs in my district. And so how is this congressional buy-in relative to this? I can see reasons why the Marine Corps wouldn't mess with the reserves, because you start messing with congressional districts and with states and things like that, and that's never an easy thing to do. But congressional buy-in, the Congress hasn't seemed too receptive to the Navy's plan to modify, buys that have been agreed upon and things like that. Will the Marine Corps run the same risk?
I mean, yes, but I think much less so. I think the Congress is going to give the Marine Corps a lot of latitude outside of a couple of areas. And it's the procurement areas that I think the Congress will be most concerned about. And if I had to pick one, it would be the F-35. But a lot of the other changes, the Congress will have some hearings. But, you know, my guess is that they will, you know, let the Marine Corps conduct its restructuring so that, you know, to pick on tanks, which has been a highly visible element. You know, if the Marine Corps wants to deactivate all those tank units, I think the Congress is going to let them do that. I say, when you get into the big procurements like F-35s, amphibious ships, you know, then that's not quite as clear. I don't think the
tanks are not an issue because they've been bought, right? The issue was the Marine Corps was going to have to buy a new tank, and which got the tank in everybody's eye. Like, do we really need this thing? Blah, blah, blah. But so I don't believe that's an issue. Let me ask you another question. And we were talking about this yesterday. Is the Marine Corps giving up its close with and destroy part of the mission?
That's an interesting question. And they would claim no, but there's no question that the thrust of this reorganization moves towards standoff combat, long-range precision effects, and by making the infantry lighter, for example, it sees the infantry much more as a commando-like force that might be protecting, fire support assets rather than the close with and destroy the enemy. Although, you know, to be fair, I mean, the Marine Corps infantry will still be able to do that, but it will take a step away from the tools that would make it most effective in doing that.
So if it degrades your ability to do it, you could put a pretty big question. In limited cases, can close with and destroy?
Right? Yes, or when reinforced. You know, they might put it that way.
I like that. In limited cases, when reinforced, right? Might be able to close with. Otherwise, local security forces for fire support assets. Right.
Yeah, and I think the Marine Corps, you know, you might make an analogy to airborne units in the Army. You know, that is much lighter, not having the full scope of heavy weapons that a regular infantry unit would have. But still having some capabilities. I think. Although the Marine Corps hasn't quite said that, but I think that their vision is something closer to that, airborne.
But the airborne relies on other forces at some point that will marry up with them. If you want to see a disaster, throw an airborne force in there by itself and watch it get chewed apart. And so to me, your hedge is the airborne is part of a subset of a larger organization that has the ass to get after that. So I ultimately, Mark, what is the motivation on the part of General Berger, right, to go all in, right? You know, 2nd Marine Division tilted to the South China Sea, 1st Marine Division tilted to the South China Sea, right? The whole force going to be tilted to a single fight and then look at everybody else and say, we don't do Windows. And to me, I don't like, does the SecDef buy that? Does the, you know, does the chairman buy that? Will Congress buy that? It seems to me, you know, we're becoming, the Marine Corps will lose its clothes with and destroy, you know, portion of the mission, except with all three of those other caveats. In certain cases, when reinforced, we might be able to, that mission, and we become the handmaiden of the Navy. Why would we do that? Why would we throw all into a single fight?
I think the Marine Corps' response would be, you know, that's where the National Defense Strategy has its focus.
Right.
You know, there's no question the National Defense Strategy talks about, focuses on great powers, China and Russia, and really gives priority to China. And if you talk about strategists around town here in Washington, they're all focused on China, much, much less on Russia. You know, Russia is, you know, much weaker than the old Soviet Union. Its, you know, ability to, you know, reach beyond its borders is quite limited. And, of course, its economics are nearly catastrophic. So, you know, it does not provide the long-term threat that the Chinese do. You know, if they keep building, you know, expanding their economy, expanding their military, modernizing their military, they would provide, you know, the premier threat in the future. So strategists are looking at the Chinese. The National Defense Strategy looks at the Chinese. And so General Berger says, okay, we're going to look at the Chinese. And and that, I think, was what drives this focus on the Chinese and hence an island campaign in the Western Pacific.
Okay, let me ask you another question. Let's just suppose the way events unfurl in this hypothetical war with China, right, that they move into the first island barrier chain. And so there is no fight in the South China Sea, right?
Yeah.
The next place that we can go to fortify and put our rockets on is what? Guam? I mean, you know, the Palu chain. I mean, now we just become an irrelevant force. If, you know, somebody sent me an email earlier today and said, hey, when Mark comes on, ask him why we would fight inside the first island chain. Why wouldn't we use that as our own barrier? And if the Chinese venture beyond that, we'll annihilate them. We can deal with what's inside the first island chain later. But why would we leverage and go all in this nuanced fight inside the first island chain? What say ye to that? I know you're saying hedge, and I believe certainly that's appropriate. But it just seems to me that even if the fight takes place, you know, beyond the first island chain, then where is the Marine Corps?
Well, again, I'd say the Marine Corps, I think, would make two arguments here. I mean, one is that this concept about distributed operations and the sea control would be part of that first island chain barrier,
right?
As well as the Navy and the Air Force and, you know, the whole joint force. But that this would be the Marine Corps' contribution, you know, setting up these bubbles, you know, along the periphery of the South China Sea and, you know, along the whole first island chain. And if, you know, driven out of the first island chain, then they would set it up, you know, the next step back. And the Marine Corps also argues that they want to be a stand-in force. And whenever I write stand-in in my word processor, you know, it kicks it out because it's that we've never heard this word before. But
so what does that mean?
Stand-in quite explicitly. And the concept there, the strategic problem both the Navy and Marine Corps face with the Chinese and also with the Russians is that they have this bubble, you know, which was caused for a long time, you know, A2AD, anti-access aerial denial. The Marine Corps is now using the phrase weapons engagement zone, WEZ, but it's the same thing. And some concepts call for them to stand outside of that bubble and then fight their way in. But the Marine Corps was worried that if if it adopted that strategy, it would really be irrelevant until the Navy and Air Force could beat down enough of this A2AD capability that they could then move in with their big amphibs and big amphibious operations. And, you know, they might be irrelevant. So they developed this alternative concept of stand-in. In other words, they would not stand outside this bubble. They would go inside the bubble and set up these their own bubbles with these anti-air, anti-sea capabilities. So it's you know, it's their effort to be relevant in, you know, the prospective fight in Western Pacific. Now, and I, you know, I think it's a good thing to pursue that concept.
Got it.
Again, I would hedge, because there were just so many uncertainties about whether you could really do this. You know, like, there's the problem about, first, how do you get there? You know, what is the mechanism that actually deposits you in this, inside the A2AD bubble? And then what keeps you supplied? Because even if you are a small mobile force, you know, that's firing off missiles at the Chinese, you still need missiles, and you need fuel, and you need food, and you just need all the other stuff that goes with supplying a military force. So you're going to need this continuous chain of supply, and, you know, how are you going to do that?
We're going to forage. I just saw an article, right?
Right. But the problem is you can't forage anti-ship missiles, you know, and it's hard even to forage food, although it's possible. You can forage fuel, but again, that's hard. So, you know, maybe the Marine Corps can figure out the logistics. One of the things that...
Yeah, but again, my question, again, not to you, Mark, but again, thinking out loud, is shouldn't that be solved? I mean, shouldn't those pieces be, some of these pieces be terra firma before we begin to dismantle the force as it exists today? Because you're giving away your chips in the bargain. And so anyway, let me ask you another question. When the maneuver warfare debate ensued in the Marine Corps, it was widely debated, right? Yep. I mean, you can go anywhere. This is all from what I've seen, and I pay attention to Marine Corps news. I mean, I pay attention to the things you write and different Marine Corps commentators. I mean, every day. I don't see a whole lot of discussion. I see this as very closely held. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I don't see a lot of debate yet either. You know, I think the problem the Marine Corps has got into, and I don't think Berger meant it this way, but, you know, once the Commandant says this is the way it's going to be, that's the end of the debate within the Marine Corps. So the only people who, you know, jump up and say, now, wait a minute, are people like you and I and a lot of people on the outside, you know, who raise these questions. Because for people on the inside, you know, the Commandant has made his decision. Right. You know, this is not up for discussion. And, you know, it has the advantage in that you can get the institution all moving in the same direction. But the downside is that you shut down debate and as a result, you know, are less, you know, are more vulnerable to surprises.
And we know that retired officers, for the most part, won't say anything either out of their – retired general officers won't say anything out of their – the whole gentleman club. You don't criticize another general officer in public.
Yes.
Because there's some pretty –
I think senior – although I will say, you know, if you look at the Wall Street Journal article, Michael Gordon's article, right, General Zinni is quoted as having some reservations also. So at least one general you know, expressed his reservations, although, of course, Zinni.
Zinni's, you know, he's the burning bush, too. When Zinni, let me tell you, when Zinni says it, you could take that shit to the bank. And to me, he is a quintessential Marine officer.
And, you know, historically, he's been willing to say those things. And, of course, you know, he spent so much time in the joint world, too, that I think maybe he feels a little less bound by the precepts of the institution.
But I think that's. And I don't want to tell general officers how to live their lives because I never was one. But to me, I mean, we have some pretty smart guys. You have, you know, General Van Riper, General Zinni, have been doing this and around this for a long time, and have made, you know, pretty, you know, significant contributions for a long time. And it would seem to me it would be interesting to hear what they had to say. Same thing with General Mattis. And but my fear is that, you know, as you said, once a commandant says this is where we're going, everybody shut up in color. And this thing has not been, at least from what I've seen, Michael Gordon is the first person to write, you know, in depth based on anything other than the commandant's initial statement last summer. And
well, yes. Now, to be sort of fair to the rest of the community, Gordon was brought in to the Marine Corps and given access
to a wide variety
of documents
that no one else had access to. He was, you know, again, somebody assessed, hey, Michael Gordon, credible guy. Let's bring him in. Let's make our case to him. Blah, 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 blah. And then hopefully, you know, he'll be fair to us. And I haven't read the article because I don't subscribe to the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, okay. Well, I will.
Can you send me a copy of Gordon's article?
I will.
Okay. All right. Now let me. So
Michael was kind enough to send me a PDF copy.
Oh, there you go. Thank you. For those people that are worried that this puts the Marine Corps on a path to it being marginalized as the service that we know, it being marginalized as a close with and destroy organization, and it becoming local security for firing batteries, what do you say, Mark? I know what you're going to say. Hedge. The commandant needs to hedge. Okay,
there you go. All right.
We're done.
I've had some success. you know, what I would say to people is, well, I've had a couple of very worried tankers. And what I've said is, you know, hedge. You know, it's – and, of course, retirees have a little more latitude. I mean, so retirees could get up there and say, hey, the commandant's all wrong. You know, he's got a – all wrong. And a few people believe that they ought to get up and say that. You know, my tack has been, no, what the commandant's doing makes a lot of sense. A lot of what he's doing makes a lot of sense, but we should hedge because the war may not be in the place where the Marine Corps is expecting, and it may not unfold the way the Marine Corps is planning. And I find that it's easier for institutions like the Marine Corps to say, hey, we're modifying our vision rather than get up and say, hey, you know, we had it all wrong.
Right.
Now, a new commandant might do that, but it's easier to say we're modifying. So, but for people on the outside, I would say, write a piece, write it for the Gazette, write a letter to the editor, you know, write a little piece in your local newspaper, you know, saying, hey, I'm worried about the direction the Marine Corps is going, and get that discussion going because it's not going to happen on the inside. I mean, the commandant has laid out a direction, and, you know, the Marines will, you know, as good Marines are, you know, will follow the commandant's direction. And that leads me to one of my hot button issues, which you raised, which is general officers and writing. I have always been amazed, and this goes way beyond the Marine Corps, that general officers do so little professional writing, particularly after they retire and are no longer, you know, restricted by, you know, their position. You know, here's a group of people, highly talented, highly educated, have risen to the top of their profession. And there are thousands of them retired general and flag officers. And the number who actually write professionally is under 10. And I've always been mystified about why that is. And I'm open, you know, I'm open to suggestions. So what I would say to all of those retired, you know, lieutenant colonels and colonels, you know, you are going to have to write because the generals, for whatever reason, you know, gentlemen's agreements about not criticizing or, you know, whatever, they rarely do.
I think it's one of the great dangers to the democracy that generals on issues of policy will not come out and express their concerns. And I think that's one of the things that paved the way for what we did in Afghanistan and what we did in Iraq. And I think that needs to change. And I would absolutely echo what you just said, Mark. I mean, I think they need to follow General Zinni's example in an articulate way, in a measured way, in a fair way, express your concern. And I think not doing so imperils or puts the nation at risk. And I would really love to see that. So anyway, I know I've taken up way too much of your time. Tell everybody where they find your work, Mark.
It is now posted. And in fact, I just sent you the link. So if you go to CSIS, it should be on my page. You can go to Experts, Mark Kansian, and there'll be a link to my analysis of the Marine Corps restructuring. And it discusses many of the points that we've talked about here on the air, goes into a little more detail.
Awesome. Sir, first of all, always appreciate it and always enjoy it. Thank you very much.
Hoorah.
There you go. Hoorah. Good luck with that homeschooling thing.
Thanks.
All right. That is Mark Kansian of the Center for Strategic and International Studies here on Wednesday. Interesting stuff. So that'll do it here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio. If you're just tuning in, we take a look at the news. Some interesting stuff in there. Women Advisory Board saying that women are should be considered for the draft, and which surprises me. But we'll see what Congress does with that. And a whole series of COVID-19 stories from around the world. So we'll take a look at that. We'll see you tomorrow. Lynch and Kenny going to join me. So have a great day.